Welcome to the Urbanist Agenda, the podcast that loves Shinkansen. I'm joined today by Greg from the YouTube channel Life Where I'm From. Hi, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. So we've been talking a bunch lately on the Nebula Slack because I'm going to Japan in a few weeks in May. And of course, when I think of Japan, one of the things I think about is your channel because, well, maybe you could explain a little bit about your channel. I've watched it several times. I love it, but I don't know if everybody listening has watched it before.
Well, thank you. Yeah. The channel is basically me trying to explain Japanese culture to people from North America. Because I'm from Canada, like right. Yourself. So that's the lens I take it from.
Yes, exactly. Fellow Canadian here.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes I dip into urban type discussions, talking about the train systems or talking about housing, just because I was here and I want to know, why is this done differently in Japan versus Canada? Why can I afford rent over here? Why don't I need to own a car? You know? Why do I enjoy biking again? Like all these types of things. So
right.
I'm trying to explain it.
Well, in many ways, like our channels are quite similar in that regard, right? Like we're contrasting our home country of Canada to the place where we've lived.
Right. You took off to the Netherlands.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I've been to Japan many times before, as I mentioned to you. I think I've probably been a dozen times, 15 times, something like that. But I have never been to Japan as a tourist. I've only ever been for business travel. And so it's a very, very different situation. So I've experienced Japan. And I've been to many of the places that a tourist wouldn't go. In fact, I've never been to a place that a tourist would go, I don't think, other than a train station. So I've experienced kind of the real Japan, but always being led around by a sales rep, right? Somebody who's a local. So it's a very strange situation. But I have experienced Japan, and I'm really excited to go there and make some videos about it. But here in this conversation, I just want to talk broad strokes about some of the big differences you've seen with respect to urban planning and mobility between Canada and Japan. So that's really it. And I think there's way more that we could talk about that we could fit into like a 45-minute, hour-long podcast anyway. So why don't we just get started with trains? Let's just start really quickly with trains. I know Canada doesn't have a lot of them, so this should hopefully be a quick conversation. But talk to me about trains.
Sure. Well, I mean, actually, coming from Vancouver, we have the SkyTrain, which is
That's pretty true.
Well known, I think. And when you're on the SkyTrain route, it's pretty damn good, actually. I really enjoyed the SkyTrain. The problem is that there's just not enough of them everywhere. So
Right. As
they build up the network, it's been getting better. But in Tokyo, the network is just incredible. Anywhere you want to go, there's basically a train going there. And if you have to walk, I mean, you don't usually walk more than 15 minutes away from the station because then there's another station.
Right.
Right? So you're always within 15 minutes of a hub. And in the more central areas, it could be 5 or 10 minutes. And if you're really far out in areas, like just happen to be some weird kind of place, you can take your bicycle there and park it at the station. So you don't need to own a car in Japan. It's a luxury, not a necessity. So that's something I've really enjoyed. Both from the cost side of things and just from the ease side of things. I don't have to worry about a vehicle. I can just take the train.
Did you own a car when you were living in Vancouver?
Yeah, it's almost a necessity. I've actually tried to always minimize car ownership or car usage. So instead of having two cars, I'm like, can I just make it with one and whatnot? Okay. And sometimes, right. You know, in Canada, when you have dual income family, the wife's working over here, the husband's working over that way. Sometimes it's very, very hard to get away without owning a car in certain places.
Yeah, actually, that's interesting. The only time that I owned a car in Canada was exactly because of that situation, because I think Vancouver's similar to Toronto in this respect, that you can live without a car as long as you live in the right place and as long as you work in the right place. And you do have to make compromises doing that, for sure, but it can be done. But the first time that we owned a car in Canada was because we were living in downtown Toronto. My wife was working in downtown Toronto. That's great. But then I got a job in the suburbs. And the only way to get there was to drive. There was technically a GO train, but it only ran from the suburbs to downtown in the morning and the other way back. So that wasn't an option to me, even though it wasn't that far from a GO train station, my work. But anyway, that's frustrating. But one of the things that I found interesting about the trains in Tokyo, for example, they really are everywhere. The map looks like somebody just took some colored markers and scribbled them all over the place. When you first look at it, you're like, is that a train map? Like, and then you realize that there's the train map and then there's the subway map that sort of go on top of each other. And it's just wild how many lines there are in stations. But it also goes out to the suburbs, right?
Yeah, yeah. Actually, that's the thing that I really enjoy about trains in Japan is not just the suburbs, but basically anywhere you want to go to in Japan, you can access by train. And some things, okay, if you take a flight, you could get there in 3 hours, but train would take 6 hours. But if you include right. the time it takes to get to the airport and do the security check-ins and whatnot, and then get from the airport to where you want to go, the train is not that different. And I'm talking about central hubs, but also like if you're going into the countryside, the Inaka in Japan, they have a lot of services that are oriented towards getting you to and from the train station. So if you're staying at a hotel or a ryokan, they'll often pick you up from the place with a shuttle bus or with their own like personal type of vehicle. So you can really get almost anywhere in the country using the train network or sometimes the bus network as well.
Yeah, and I found that always very interesting because when we would go to customer sites, so when I used to work in the PC industry, for example, if I was going to, I don't know, just say Dell or HP who are in Texas, there's no way I was getting there without renting a car. It was just literally impossible. Even a taxi would be very expensive even to get out to where they were. But if I was going to see, say, Toshiba, well, like if I was going to see Fujitsu, they're right in Tokyo. There's a train station right there. But if I was going to see Toshiba's laptop division, for example, which are in a city in the north, it's a fair ways out, we would still take the train there and then it would be a very, very short taxi ride. We probably could have walked it, but you know, you're in business suits and you're in a rush and everything like that. But within a 5-minute taxi, there we are at some like what felt like a relatively industrial factory kind of environment, right? And we could still get there by train. But that goes for also the suburbs where people live, too, and all of that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like I said, you can get pretty far away from Tokyo out in the suburbs. And like, there are different prefectures, actually.
Right.
Right? Because when people think about Tokyo, they think, oh, it's 37 million. But that's like the Tokyo metropolitan area. But actual metropolitan Tokyo is only 13 million, the population. So it triples in size because you have extra cities and extra prefectures that are added into the whole, you know, entire metro area. And like metro, metropolitan, what's the difference? But I think Tokyo metropolitan is the 13 million and Tokyo, the, I'm even confusing myself, but there's a 37 million one and there's a 13 million one. And there's the 23 special wards, which is really what people think of Tokyo, the city part. And that's like 9 million. So depends what level you're going to, but whatever the level is, yeah, you can get train access.
Hmm. That's always so interesting to me. And one of the other things that I find is very interesting is that when you get to a train station, and it doesn't matter whether it's an urban train station or a suburban train station, there's things right outside of it, right? Like as soon as you step out of the station, there's things all around you.
Yeah, yeah, that's a huge benefit. So I mentioned that there's bike parking at pretty much all the stations. And generally, they could be like 100 yen, which is like roughly like a dollar to park your bike there for about 24 hours. Right. But they have shopping and convenience stores. So you can get your groceries there. You can get your ATMs, your banking done. You can get your postage mailing stuff done. Any kind of service you want is generally located around the stations. They're kind of like the hubs of communities. And I think a part of this reason is that the operators themselves, they tend to own the property around the station.
Yeah.
Depends which line, which company and whatnot. But they have an incentive to get people to that station and to use that station. And it helps their ridership. And so it's kind of like a nice symbiotic relationship there with the lines and the stations being commercial hubs.
Yeah, that is interesting you brought that up, actually, because that reminds me that I often see discourse online about privatized railways versus public-owned railways, and there's argument back and forth about which one is the better approach. But one of the things I find interesting is when people say, oh, well, privatized railways can be great. Look at Japan. And I think that is true. They are privatized railways. But what I find interesting about the income of Japanese railways is that they're actually real estate companies that also run trains.
Yeah, I think that is a big key thing, yeah.
And you see the same thing with the Hong Kong MTR. It's exactly the same model. They own a whole bunch of real estate and then they rent it out. And that's where all the money comes from because they own all the shops and everything around the metro stations. So yeah, that is interesting. And I find when people get in that discourse, they totally don't understand that. They think that they're making money off of the trains when really they're mostly making money off of the real estate. But
yeah, yeah. And there are certain instances where they are making money off the trains. Like
yeah,
I think the Shinkansen between Tokyo, then goes to Nagoya, and Kyoto, Osaka, that's like a big moneymaker from what I've read. That brings in the coin. But you're going out to other areas, then sometimes they're running other things at a loss, the actual train lines, and they have to make up the money from real estate and other profitable train lines. So it's a mix.
I guess in a sense, it's a little bit like Ryanair too. They send you to these tiny little airports in the middle of nowhere, but then Ryanair also owns all of the shops and everything and is making money every step of the way of you being in that small airport. But anyway, one of the things that I find interesting about that, like I said, you step out of the train station, there's a bunch of stuff there. But it's also not very far to get to your destination on foot or by bike, even in relatively suburban areas, right? Like they have single family homes in some of these places that I've been to in suburban Tokyo, but it's nothing like Canada, right?
Yeah, I guess when you say suburban, I'm always trying to picture, okay, how suburban is suburban? Because...
Right. We would call it very urban. I think if you showed a picture of it to somebody in Canada, they're like, well, that's in the middle of a city. But it's really not, right? Like,
yeah, I think it just depends on your perspective, right? The thing that surprised me when I was coming into Tokyo for the very first time, I was coming from Narita Airport.
Yeah.
And if you know Narita Airport, it's about like an hour's train ride from like the boundaries of the 23 special wards of Tokyo, which people consider like the main kind of part of the city. And going in, I'm like, okay, I'm in Tokyo already. I see all this housing, all these buildings, everything. And it's like, no, it's not yet. my wife was saying, right?
Yeah.
And then my brothers, when they came in, they had the same reaction coming in. They thought that was the city, but no, you have to like go in a lot more. But the thing is, with even like what Japanese would consider a small station, it's really quite dense. And that has a lot to do with the zoning and the permissions that they have associated with it. So I made a whole video about the zoning, but basically, you know, now there's like 13 zones, but it starts off at like low rise residential. And in that zone, you can have single family homes, but you can also have businesses that are within your home. You can run like very small businesses. So already you have like this mixed use type of thing.
Right.
But there's not very many of that type in Tokyo. It's very, very tiny percentage. Like I want to say under 5%, it could even be lower of like the, you know, extremely low rise. But the next category up, it allows apartment buildings like up to basically three stories. And it just keeps on going on from there more and more permissive. So even if you get into commercial areas or light industrial areas, you're still allowed to build housing at all these points. And you're still allowed to have these apartment buildings that just kind of get bigger and bigger and bigger as the zones, you know, progress. So you're getting a lot more density and a lot more people wanting to live in areas and a lot more people allowed to live in areas with that type of zoning.
Right. I mean, like if you're working anywhere, it is possible for you, whether you want to or not is a different issue, but it's possible for you to live very close to where you work, regardless of what that job is.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I used to be in the food business way back when, and it's always surprising to me, like going back and forth between the countries and seeing the types of small businesses that can survive in Japan that just can't make it in Canada. Because you can just run like a little restaurant out of the bottom floor of your home or the front portion of your home. Like that's totally fine. In Canada, that's almost an impossibility. I mean, it just depends on which jurisdiction you're in and some other things, but it's very, very hard. The hurdles for a commercial kitchen are just really, really high in Canada, that is.
That's actually something that used to be relatively common in Canada, actually, of people running shops outside of the front of their homes. But then that was made illegal in the mid-20th century.
And so if you get grandfathered into that, then maybe you could have a spot still.
Yeah.
And those places are kind of popular, I noticed. If I walk around certain neighborhoods,
yeah,
it's like
that
corner shop, you know, has a cafe underneath or the grocery store. And it's like in the middle of this just single family housing. You're like, okay, like people really like this spot. It's like, yes, it used to be called hipster back then, but I don't know what it's called now.
Yeah, it'll be the little local cafe, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we used to live in Riverdale in Toronto, which is a fantastic neighborhood, but it is grandfathered in. That's the only reason that exists. And so on the corner of each intersection, most intersections, they'll have like a little commercial space and it could be anything. It could be a pet food store. It could be a coffee shop. It could be whatever. And people love those things. Actually, this is one of these things that kind of annoys me about my channel is that I talk about these things and then they'll say like, oh, you're full of it, man. That exists in Canada, too. You keep talking like it doesn't exist. And I'm like, it only exists in a very, very narrow region where it happened to be grandfathered in and it didn't get bulldozed and it's still there and it still exists to this day. I mean, that doesn't really count. Like, yeah, okay, you can find it, but we're not building any new ones. In fact, it's illegal to build any new ones. But in Japan, I mean, Japanese zoning is actually fantastically interesting. And I'll definitely put your video about it in the show notes because I think people should watch that. I think it's just so interesting the way they do it. It's fundamentally different. As you said, they have the least permissible, but even then it allows mixed use and then it gets more and more permissible from there. But what's also interesting is that's assigned at federal level, I believe, right? Like it's just across the whole country. This is the way it is.
Yeah. At the national level, they have this blanket kind of like, here's the 13 zones you can choose from.
Right.
And you can prescribe different, like, okay, your building to floor ratio is like a certain percentage point. And there's other like things you can like plug in, you know, so your city, you can plug in these different factors, but it's that template that you're working from. And it kind of has like 90% of the work done for you. And so you can just tweak the little details you want for your city.
Right.
Now, there are cities that can do special things. So like Kyoto, you know, a very historical place, they're trying to preserve some buildings. And so they have certain restrictions that they add on top of that. But that's kind of like the exception versus the norm.
Right.
I believe there's a few districts in Tokyo that has similar things. But I think to me, that's kind of a good balance because if like 90 or 95% is basically the standard and, you know, 5 or 10% are the exceptions, then you're kind of, yeah, using those exceptions to preserve certain things that are really unique or interesting or world heritage.
Right.
But for the rest, like, you don't need to overthink things. Like, it's already been thought out at the national level. You just, you know, follow the route. And I think having it at the national level too helps the builders as well and purchasers. Because it's the same set of like standards and laws anywhere you go in Japan. So if you're moving to a few blocks over, but it's a different city, but it's basically the same type of rule set you're working with.
Right. I think that's actually critically important because these companies do like build expertise around it and have experts who work for them. And if it's different in every single city and every single district, and there's all this red tape, then it does make it just more difficult, more expensive to build things commercially for sure. And I'm generally in favor of good building regulations, but on this kind of ridiculous stuff that North American municipalities get involved with about what you can and can't build, it gets kind of crazy. And I think, so one of the other things I want to talk to you about here is that effect on housing prices, right? And housing construction, because it's interesting to me, there's a housing crisis happening here in the Netherlands, but of course it's just as bad in Canada. It's bad in most places in the developed world. The housing prices are just going out of control. With the big exception of Japan, right? Like housing prices are still extremely affordable, relatively speaking, in Japan. So tell me a little bit about like why you think that is.
Right. Well, I'll start off with saying that I still want to do some more investigation in terms of the building costs, because I have a cookie cutter home in Tokyo that probably architects don't like very much because you can see the same house built like so many different places or variations of it, right? A lot of people will say it's like a crap house. And I was like, is this really like a bad house? Like Japan has earthquake laws. And so they have to be built to withstand certain levels of earthquake. This has insulation, has double pane windows. And when I moved from places like my wife's family's house, which was built like 40, 50 years ago, and then went to an apartment that was built about 30 years ago, and then moved into this house, this is now about 7, 8 years old. I don't even know how old it is anymore. You can notice the difference in the amount of heating and cooling that you need, and your energy bills are going down, the water usage. Like, it's a very efficient house in comparison to what was built before. But I hear online all the time, like, oh, Japanese houses are crap. They're just absolutely terrible. They get torn down in like 30 years. And I don't think that's true anymore. Like after the war, they were built very cheaply. They didn't have a lot of materials. Then yeah, those houses were tear down. Earthquakes would happen. They would redo the laws. And so nobody wanted old homes, so they'd tear them down. But nowadays, with the standards that are being built, on the books, they'll say, okay, your house is a write-off after, I believe it's 30 years. But I don't think these houses are going to be write-offs after that time. And I want to talk to architects and building professionals to see the quality of materials versus what you would get in, say, like the Netherlands or Canada and see just like, are they building like crappier homes in Japan? Is that why they're a lot cheaper? So that's one angle.
Well, I don't know. Like whenever I talk to somebody in Toronto who bought a condo off a plan, they tell me all of the things that effectively just fall apart over the first 5 years. So I don't get the impression that they're being built very well in Canada either. It does depend on the builder, though.
Yeah, yeah. But the one thing that I can point to that I do believe has a huge difference, I mean, it goes down to the zoning and the minimum lot sizes and the permissions. So you only need 60 centimeters of access to a road in order to build your home, right? That's incredibly small.
That is incredibly small.
That's like basically like a doorways type of width. And so I've been, you know, taking pictures actually for you about narrow streets.
Nice.
About these little tiny pathways. And you're like, well, why do they have these pathways between the homes? Well, sometimes those pathways are the only access to a home. Right?
Right.
You definitely can't park a car in there.
Yeah, that meets the legal requirement of being 60 centimeters access to a road. And then it goes back a ways to the actual house.
Yeah. And there's a lot of housing designs, like new developments that are based off of that kind of minimum requirement. But also there's the minimum lot size. Like there basically is no minimum lot size. Like you need 60 centimeters access. But I just did a thin buildings video, thin buildings in Japan. And you can have very, very tiny slices of land and throw a building up on there and do what you like with it. You can run a business and you can have your home over there. So things are sized all different sorts of ways. So you notice if you go out into the countryside of Japan, they actually have bigger homes and they start getting more like Canadian sized when they have a lot of room. But in Tokyo, space is at a premium. So most people, they can't afford to have like a Canadian sized single family home smack dab in Tokyo. I mean, you know, it's expensive, right? But if you're like an average, you know, working class type of family, you can definitely afford to own a single family home or like a condo, what they call mansion, but it's like basically like a concrete type of building because you can size it to what you need. So if you need 500 square feet or you need 700 square feet or 1,000 square feet, are for those professionals. They'd only need like 200 or 300 square feet.
Right.
Like you have homes of all those different sizes and you have so many of them because they keep on building that the pricing is still relatively affordable, I'd say, in comparison to other major cities around the world.
Right. I think that is interesting about having houses of all different sizes. This is something that certainly was more normal all around the world, but with strict zoning, it's changed a lot. And one of the things that I've noticed in suburban developments in Canada, for example, they'll build a bunch of single family homes out in the middle of nowhere on a greenfield development. But all of those homes will be around the same size and they'll be all at around the same price point. So they'll sell for, I don't know, 600,000 or something like that. And that is the price of a home. And there's some that are a little bit bigger and some that are a little bit smaller, but they're all pretty much in that narrow band. And that has some really weird effects in general, I think, for society. Like everybody there is pretty much the same socioeconomic bracket as you. But also, as we see with baby boomers who are empty nesters, and now they're living in this massive home all by themselves, and then one of the couple dies, and then there's one person living in this 5-bedroom house in some suburban development in the middle of nowhere. And that's weird, because those people also can't, for example, sell their house and move to something smaller without also giving up their neighborhood and any of their connections that they have and that kind of thing. Whereas I think when you look at something like Japan, there's so many options that if you outgrow your home because you need something bigger or it is now too big because your children have left, there will be options for you. You'll be able to stay in that same neighborhood.
Yeah, actually, that's a really good point about it. The neighborhood where I'm in, it's interesting because I think right before I was going to buy, I looked at the reports for what they expected the growth would be in the city. Mm-hmm. And it was going to be declined. But I was like, okay, that's pretty common. Like everyone knows the population in Japan is declining. But actually, the population did not decline. It's actually increased year over year in the area that I'm in. And in Tokyo, it's still been increasing as far as I know. And part of the reason is that they can take those old homes and they used to take a certain area and they would cut it in two and make two like smaller single family homes, or they would make an apartment like just right across from me. It used to be a parking lot, but now it's an apartment of single units. I believe they're like 300 square feet or so. So for one or two people.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're relatively affordable. I think they're like $700 a month to rent or $800 a month to rent. And then, you know, down the street, there's a bigger apartment building with like 2-bedroom units or 3-bedroom units and whatnot. And so you have a mix, like you were saying, of all the different types of homes. And for people at different stages, at different income levels, they can kind of find a place. And so I've noticed with my wife's family and other people that I know that you can still live in the same neighborhood that your parents were. And your kids can actually still afford to live in the same neighborhood. And if people move out, they can still like come back. Like in Canada, I find that like it's very tough. Like sometimes if you bought early enough and you're in the certain area, then you can be in. But like, if you go out and try to come back 5 years later, sometimes you're like, oh, well, you're screwed now. Sorry.
Well, yeah, I feel that way. Well, I mean, that's absolutely the case for us. For example, in Riverdale, where we lived in Toronto, we bought into Riverdale. We bought a semi-detached home there when we moved back to Canada from Brussels. So that was 2014. And it was right on the edge of what we could afford. Like, we were actually stretching that. But now that it's, you know, 10 years later, there's no way in hell we could afford anything in Riverdale. Certainly not that house, but really nothing. And so now we could never go back there. It's just not possible.
Yeah, that's basically the same with me in Canada as well. I would have to really stretch myself to have gotten into the housing market. And then, yeah, a decade later, if I tried to do it now, like, it's just an impossibility to go anywhere in the lower mainland. For me, I'd have to move back to my hometown of Winnipeg in order to be able to afford something.
Right. Yeah. And I think, I mean, when you think about the effects of that for social cohesion, right? I mean, that's incredibly powerful to be able to live in the same place for your whole life if you want to. And again, as you said, you can also move away and you can always come back, which is also incredibly powerful. Because, for example, if you leave your parents' home and you go do your own thing, but then your parents are older and they need to be cared for, you could move back to the neighborhood right next to where your mother or father live. And I think that's incredibly powerful in general for society.
It's nice. I mean, I grew up, I was not rich at all. We were like below the poverty line at certain points in our lives, my family. And I know what it's like to be poor. But you think about the people working at the cafes, at the restaurants, at the hardware store, any of these retail type jobs, like not everyone can make a ton of money, right? And so what about those people that, you know, are just working like regular jobs or minimum wage jobs? Where are they going to live? Do they have to live 2 hours away to commute in? Can they live, you know, within a decent commute of where they work? And I think the answer in Tokyo is that they actually can. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that they're living like these super awesome lives. They're probably still struggling to pay their bills. Like, I don't doubt that for, you know, the really poor people, but it's just at a different level than it is from what I'm seeing in certain areas of Canada at the moment.
Yeah. Well, Canada is going crazy.
Because even like middle income people in like, say, the lower mainland, I mean, I have no clue. Like, if you didn't get in before a certain time, if you don't have a good landlord that you've been with for a certain length of time where your rent is locked in, like, it's so hard to start out right now with the current climate. You have to be kind of like, grandfathered in into the area.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, and in Canada, and certainly we're seeing it too in the Netherlands, that it's not just like minimum wage workers that are having trouble. It's nurses and teachers and all sorts of other people who just can't live near their jobs. So back to Japan, though, I mean, the thing that kind of makes that possible is two things. One, it's the exceptional transportation options, usually by train, that go everywhere, that you can live wherever you can afford. And second of all, with this more permissive zoning, lots and lots and lots of options can be built. And so nobody's coming down from on high and saying this will only be for this socioeconomic status here in this big area and other people are over here. Because there are all those options and because the transportation is so exceptional, it really opens up the possibilities on where you can live, what size of apartment or house that you want or need. And yeah, it's just a totally different world there, right?
Yeah. No, I definitely feel it. And a note about the transportation is that most jobs provide public transportation expense. Mm. I mean, this is in Tokyo I'm talking about. You're expected to commute in probably by train. Like, sometimes you might take a bus or something else. And weirdly, they don't want you to take your bike. I don't know if you knew this or not.
Oh, that's interesting. I haven't heard that.
It's for insurance reasons. And I don't know why they just can't put some insurance on it to, like, you know, fix that little thing. But it's one of those weird things where, like, sometimes people have to hide the fact that they would actually take their bike in to work. Yeah, I don't know how many jobs, 100% of them are, like, certain points, but I know there are people who work at jobs and companies where they don't want you taking your bike.
That's incredible.
But the transportation is so incredible around the Tokyo area that you can get away without taking a bicycle. That's fine. You can always walk to all the stations around here.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We should probably talk about bikes a little bit. And this is one of the things that I want to explore a little bit when I'm in Japan in a few weeks. Japan has a strange relationship with bicycles because, you know, we've talked a lot here already in this conversation about the trains, but Tokyo can be surprisingly car friendly at times too. Like, there are some very wide roads and high-speed roads at times, as well as lots and lots of narrow streets. But you can have these wide roads sometimes, and they don't have any bike lanes on them or anything like that.
They generally don't, or if they do, it's just like that painted, you know, blue or green lane with no barriers. And so cars will park in there. I don't trust them. A lot of people don't trust them.
No, neither do I.
And sometimes they'll have like lanes that'll be part of the sidewalk. They'll have like sometimes really wide sidewalks, and they'll have a sign saying this is for pedestrians, this is for bikes. But pedestrians just walk everywhere, and bikes just have to end up weaving in and out of people. Like, it's not necessarily the best system in certain parts in terms of what you would think of as like designing proper bike lanes and bike paths.
And yet what you find in many cities in Japan is that they have a higher level of bicycle use than you would find, for example, in Canada or something like that. And so I find that a lot of this happens not because of the infrastructure, like in the Netherlands, where the infrastructure enables that, but rather in spite of the infrastructure. And maybe we could talk a little bit about like where people do cycle and why, because I think that's actually really interesting.
Right. Well, I think people are generally not doing the long commutes. They're not hopping on their bike and going for an hour-long ride through the pristine bike lanes to their workplace. They're doing a lot of local stuff. And so the thing about the local is that all the little side streets, their max speed is generally 30 kilometers an hour. For American, what is that?
I think it's 20 miles 20? Per hour.
20-ish? 20 miles an hour?
I know that from those UK adverts to say 20 is plenty.
20 is plenty. Okay. Right. So 20 is plenty. So 30 kilometers an hour, 20 miles per hour is not very fast. And so even if they don't have sidewalks on these roads, the cars are going so slow that basically the priority is pedestrians and cyclists.
Yeah.
So you could just like cycle your bike right in the middle of the road and a car is not going to run you over. They probably are not even going to honk at you if you're in the way, you know, like you might notice them. And then like, if you're a nice person, you're like, move aside and let them pass through. But the level of, I guess, access that provides, because most of the streets are smaller side streets that are lower speed. And so people are going to do their daily things via these types of streets. So whether it's to pick up your groceries or to drop your kid off at daycare, or your kids are walking towards their school. You see so many people like walking to the train station. You always see more people on these streets, whether they're on bicycles or whether they're walking, than you do see in automobiles.
Right. So a couple of things there. Even in the Netherlands, when a street is 30 kilometers an hour, it typically doesn't require a bicycle lane. They can put it in if they want to, or if there's some reason for it. But the general approach is that smaller streets in the Netherlands that are 30 kilometers an hour or less will just have no bicycle infrastructure. And people just do exactly that, just ride in the middle of the road. And the classification there, in case anyone's interested, is called an Erftuchungsweg, but it's basically a local access street. But this is exactly what I find in Japanese cities, is that you will have these big avenues for cars, and they're actually quite unpleasant at times. But most of the action is happening in these little, what we would call in North America, even alleyways, but they're not. Mm-hmm. They're streets, but they're very, very narrow, right? And as you said, there's no sidewalk. And so you might look at that and think, oh my God, there's no sidewalk on these streets. But these streets are so narrow in some cases that it's really just a shared space, right?
Yeah, that's true. And actually, there's an interesting network of alleyways just for pedestrians or cyclists that go between homes and other places that a car could definitely not fit into. Mm-hmm. So there's that whole network kind of behind the scenes that some people probably don't even realize when they look at a place like Tokyo. But the thing that I forgot to mention with, you know, all this zoning and housing and whatnot talk is that there is no on-street parking in Tokyo, basically, right?
Yes.
And there's no minimum parking requirements for buildings.
Oh, yes. This is actually really interesting. I'm glad you brought it
up. Right? So when you're riding down these streets, you're not really worried about people like opening their car door and you're getting smoked.
Right.
When you're going by, like, that's not a major problem. If you do go to Tokyo and you walk around, you'll see that, okay, yeah, like the service vehicle, this courier, they're temporarily parking at these areas and dropping off their stuff and whatnot, doing their thing. But you're generally not contending with parked cars. So even on the bigger roads that you're talking about, you're not combating that problem as much as you would in North America. So when I'm riding, I feel way, way safer in Tokyo than I do even sometimes in bike lanes in Vancouver area.
Yeah, and that's such an interesting point that when you buy a car in Japan, you need to prove that you have a parking space for it that's off the street. And in most places, it is illegal to park overnight. So
yeah,
as you said, you don't see parked cars all over the place like you do even here in the Netherlands. Parked cars line like every street.
But also, you know, in terms of housing affordability, that obviously takes out that parking cost.
Yes.
From the houses. So you yes. don't have to pay for that as a default.
Yeah, and that's a good point as well.
And so sometimes people would wonder, like, how do you get around that, right? So if, like, you go to live in an apartment building or you have a house that doesn't have a parking spot, like, what do you do? Well, for the people that actually want to have a car, you can just rent a spot.
Right.
Because, again, the zoning is very permissive. Like, so if I want to bulldoze the house over there and build a parking lot, I can. And then 2 years later, I want to build a house there, I can. You don't have to go through this like community process and get approval. Like you can just do it. So there are parking lots all over Tokyo, even like the rich areas that I went to. Like there's parking lots and you can rent it on a monthly basis or a daily basis. And you do, like you said, need to prove that you have a parking spot for your car before you buy one in the area.
Mm-hmm. I think that's just so interesting. It's such a different approach because like in almost every other country, you just go and buy a car and then you stuff it wherever you can and figure it out later. And a lot of the times drivers then just expect that this spot in front of their house is theirs and they can take it. And that's also where you get all these fights when you want to redesign the street to make something better, as all these people get upset that you're taking away their parking. And that's actually, in my experience, the number one most contentious issue around any urban development project anywhere in North America. It comes down to parking. That's the one that...
Really? The parking?
Oh, they get so upset about it. I've been to meetings where people are literally standing up and screaming at each other and throwing things around parking. And it's always the parking.
I mean, I guess it's the mind shift, right? Of thinking like, yeah, this public parking spot in front of my home is my spot.
Yeah, it's mine.
Right? Especially when you have to clear the snow in certain areas of Canada. Like, that's my spot. I worked for that spot, but it's a public parking place. But if you try to take it away from the people, yeah, I guess it can be contentious.
Parking is always the most contentious thing. But I find it interesting when walking around a Japanese city, there'll be all these small, narrow streets, again, with no parking on it. But then you'll see a car kind of tucked off to the side, or you'll come around the corner and there will be, like you said, a little parking lot. But the parking lot will be sometimes like six cars, not like 50 cars or something like that. It'll be like wherever there's a little space that they could make, they've squeezed a car in there. And of course, the cars are typically quite a bit smaller in Japan as well.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another big thing too, is that you can have small cars. They're called K cars. They're like light cars.
Yeah.
And I think they're not street legal in certain parts of North America.
Yeah.
Because the big SUV would just crush it.
Yeah. And it's really kind of sad because obviously I've made a lot of content and talked a lot about SUVs and trucks and all that kind of thing. And so one of the things that pops up quite often is that you'll have these little K-car pickup trucks, for example, and the bed length will be the same as this giant Ford F-150. So the bed is exactly the same. It carries exactly the same amount, but the F-150 is four times larger. It's absolutely wild. But what I find interesting there, again, coming back to the housing costs, because when it comes down to what causes the development of housing to be expensive in North America, there is the zoning, but there's lots of other regulations that come into there as well. And one of the most damaging is this idea of minimum parking requirements, that you need a parking space per 1.5 bedrooms, or for every 100 square feet of shop space, you need to have two parking spots or whatever it might be. And that's just bundling the cost of all that into everything. Like every house needs to be more expensive. If you go and build an apartment building, for example, you're going to have to put there, it could be 200, 300 parking spaces. And of course, that's there whether those people are going to drive or not. That's just going to have to be built. And it's usually built as underground parking garages, which are very, very expensive to build, right? So in Japan, you can just plop a small apartment building or even a large apartment building down, and you don't have to put any parking in at all if you don't want to.
I mean, that's basically what I have right across from my house.
Right.
Exact same situation, yeah.
And the cost of that is significantly lower because building underground parking garages is expensive. And certainly devoting large chunks of land to surface parking lots is, again, very expensive. And what you've seen in, well, this has been talked about time and time again. I know Climate Town has a good video about it as well, that downtowns in Canada were bulldozed literally because if you wanted to renovate a shop and open there, you needed a parking space. And there were no parking spaces. It wasn't enough to meet requirements. So they would literally bulldoze the building next to it to put a surface parking lot down. And I certainly see that in my hometown of London, Ontario. Like half of it is surface parking lots because of these minimum parking requirements. I mean, it's literally destroying our cities, but also it's putting that added cost onto everything, whether you want it or not.
Yeah, I think that's the thing is like sometimes when I talk to people in Canada, not even specifically ask them about it, just kind of hear their opinions about housing or cars and whatnot, they think you're taking away their freedom, right? Mm-hmm. If you want to have this type of style of option. But like, I kind of think of it as the opposite, whereas like, I feel like in Tokyo, you have a lot of freedom because if you want to have your single family home and you want to have like a massive backyard, and you want to have like 3-car garage, you can do it.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
You can totally do it. You just need to pay for it, right? So in my area, that would probably cost you like, you know, a couple $1 million, which is kind of what a house costs in Lower Mainland right now.
Right, exactly.
But you can also get a house for like, you know, $300,000 or $400,000 or $500,000, and you can size it to your need. And if you want to have parking, you can. If you don't, you don't. Like, it's a lot more freedom in a lot of ways. But I think when you talk about reforming things in North America, like, okay, let's not have, you know, parking requirements. Let's take out on-street parking. Let's allow more different types of lot sizes and mixed use. People think you're taking away their freedom.
Yeah, well, I think I'm probably not going to go into it here, but I get really frustrated with that whole freedom thing. I've talked about that in many videos before. I think, honestly, that's car industry propaganda as far as I'm concerned, because cars also saddle you with massive costs and liabilities and everything else. And that's not freedom. Freedom is being able to choose. And I think it's been horribly twisted, that phrase of cars and freedom, and I hate it. But I think one of the other issues here with Canada is that people will say that if their cars are restricted, they're taking away freedoms. In a sense, it's true, but that's because every other option was destroyed, bulldozed, removed. Now, one of the issues here with these minimum parking requirements is that you were required to build all of this parking. And so houses needed to have parking. And there's two effects of this. One of them is that when you have parking, you're more likely to drive. That's just something that has been proven time and time again. When parking is there, people will drive. When people have parking spaces, they're more likely to buy a car. And that induces people to drive more than they otherwise would. And the second problem is, whenever you build things for parking and cars in general, everything gets more spread out, which makes it more difficult to get to by any other method of transportation. It becomes too far to walk. It becomes too dangerous to cycle. And public transit becomes very unaffordable because it's hard to service those very low density areas. And that's happened because of the cars. So in a sense, people have become so locked into their cars and restricted by the infrastructure that's been built for cars that now they need them. Well, that's what I say. They're addicted to cars. So then, yeah, you're taking away their freedom, not because cars are inherently free, but because cars in general have made it so that nothing else is possible.
Yeah, you know, I totally get your point on that one. And that's something I have been really thinking about is like, well, what happens if we try to take Japanese zoning and, you know, threw it into a city in Canada, like take Vancouver, like what would it look like? What would change? And I haven't made the series and maybe I'll do it one day, but one of the biggest things I thought would probably stop it is just the people, because it's like the mind shift around it. Because I think you're right. It's like, you know what I'm saying? Like, okay, just change this, just change this, just change this. But you know, it's not going to happen like that in real life. Like there's so many different things that have to change in like a typical Canadian city to make it like, say, Tokyo, right? And it won't happen overnight. It would take decades to get everything through. And there's going to be pains in that. So yeah, if you took away the parking in front of people's homes, that's going to screw over a lot of people right now. Mm-hmm. And it would, all intents and purposes, for that period of time, take away their freedom. So I also do get the other side of the argument. It's not an easy problem to solve.
I think the issue, though, is that you've seen the alternative, right? You've lived the alternative. You know it. Like, I think if I had taken you when you had only ever lived in Winnipeg and had this conversation, or certainly if we had this conversation when I was only living in London, Ontario, and you were only living in Winnipeg, we would be absolutely on the opposite side of this conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
We would say, you are insane. Are you crazy? I couldn't wait to be 16 so that I could drive. What is wrong with you?
Yeah, no, that's true. I got my license when I'm 16 years old in three days.
Me too. I was like ready. I had the paper test done already, and I was just chomping at the bit to become 16 so that I could do those final pieces.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think the thing is, though, that things are changing, and I think it really is the housing crisis that's pushing it. Because you'll see, for example, in Ontario, there's a big push in Toronto. There's a big push to allow more permissive zoning. Still not good enough. But they're saying, for example, you can build, I think it's a threeplex, three houses on one lot. And Vancouver has a similar thing, from my understanding.
Yeah, it's actually as far as I know, it's the BC government. So the province has come down and said that all these different areas, they have to change their zoning laws. So it's a little bit like Japanese style in a way, where it's like a higher up government that's telling the locals, this is the way it's going to work. And it's supposed to get more permissive. And they even have something special for the transit hubs. So whether it's a SkyTrain or whether it's the bus network, if there's a major station within a certain radius around it, that they have to allow certain types of buildings and certain heights. And mm-hmm. So I've seen some things in the past, you know, few years starting to go in the right direction. So I'm, you know, hopeful for that. But I also know, like, these things take a long time, and it's still probably not far enough to go where I think a lot of people need it to go.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the thing, is that there will be resistance to any of this. There's always resistance to any change, period. But I think in this case, the housing crisis has become so bad that it becomes very, very difficult to argue against that. Because on one hand, you've got like people living in their giant single family homes and driving everywhere and saying, no, I like it the way it is. And then on the other side, there's a horde of people that said, I can't even afford to live anymore. And then that very much changes the discussion. That's where I think we're finally starting to see some cracks in all of this in North America. But again, this is something that is going to take generations to solve, because even if you implement this overnight, you still need to rebuild everything.
Yeah.
And put all the transit in place and everything else. But that's probably as good a place as any to end this conversation, I think, because I know that there's a lot more that we can talk about. And I would actually like to have you back sometime to talk more about it, because there's so much to talk about with Japan. I was saying to my wife that we're going over there, we're going as a family vacation, but then I'm also going to take some time just for not just bikes. And there's all these topics I want to cover. And I'm like, my challenge is cutting them down.
Yeah.
To something that I could reasonably do. Because I think, I mean, as you've shown as well, you could make an entire YouTube channel out of this, of course, right? Like, there's so many topics to talk about.
You could. Yeah.
So anyway, thanks so much for coming on. Do you just want to plug your channel a little bit and tell people what it's all about, what they can expect? I know we mentioned a little bit at the beginning, but just at the end here to promote Life Where I'm From, because it is a great channel.
Yeah, no, not so much. I don't need to really promote Life Where I'm From. I mean, I think if people hear me talking about these things, they get interest into it. So if you want to know about, yeah, all these little things about Japan, whether it's the zoning or whether it's the convenience stores, which I never talked about, or housing. And
oh, yeah. I mean, that would be another whole stuff. I would love to talk to you about Japanese convenience stores, because I also lived in Taiwan with the same kind of thing.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I talk about all those things, but I think it's my viewers that will be upset, because on some of my videos, I think they saw your comments. Because you commented on, I think, my What a Tokyo Neighborhood is Like video.
Right.
And Not Just Bikes, like, I want to have this collab. And so people have been asking me for a collab with Not Just Bikes, and we miss each other by a few days. So another time.
I know, it's so frustrating that you're leaving Japan a few days before I get there. Otherwise, but we'll make that happen someday.
Yeah. Yeah.
But for now, we have this conversation.
There you go. This is the voice only collab.
Yeah, right. Well, thanks so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. And yeah, anytime, just give me a show.
That's all we have today for the Urbanist Agenda, but if you just can't wait to hear the next episode, I recommend you sign up to Nebula, because every episode is uploaded there first. You can sign up at nebula.tv/agenda, and doing so also supports this podcast. Nebula also gives you access to all of the other creators who are on there, which is now over 150 at this point. You'll find videos and podcasts and classes, but there are also Nebula Originals, which are high-budget productions by content creators you may already know on a whole wide range of educational subjects. If you sign up with our link, that's nebula.tv/agenda, then you'll get a discount off a yearly membership. That's $20 off, bringing it down to $30 per year, which is honestly a hell of a deal for what you're getting. Thanks again for listening to the Urbanist Agenda, and maybe next time you'll be listening on Nebula, and then you won't even hear this part.